From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Molly Reynolds. She is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank based in Washington. Our topic, what does a divided Congress mean for President Joe Biden's legislative agenda? Now that the bulk of the U.S. midterm election results are in, we have a much clearer idea of the contours of the House of Representatives. The lower chamber of Congress, currently controlled by the Democrats, will transfer to Republican hands in January 2023. Republicans clinched a narrow majority of the lower chamber seats in the recent midterm election. Nonetheless, the Democrats retained their razor-thin majority in the upper chamber, or Senate, thanks to Vice President Kamala Harris, who can cast a tie-breaking vote. If Democrats win a runoff race in Georgia on December 6, they will solidify their majority without needing the vice president to break a tie. So what can we expect from divided government in the upcoming 118th Congress? Despite controlling the Senate and the White House, Democrats should brace for considerable pushback on their domestic and foreign policy legislative agenda, analysts say. We have the perfect guest to preview the new political landscape. Molly Reynolds studies Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedure affect domestic policy outcomes. She is the author of the book, Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate, which explores the so-called budget reconciliation process and other procedures which prevent filibusters in the U.S. Senate. We'll have more on that in our Q&A. Her current research projects include work on oversight in the House of Representatives, congressional reform, and the congressional budget process. She previously served as a senior research coordinator in the Governance Studies program at Brookings. In addition, she has served as an instructor at George Mason University, located in nearby Northern Virginia. And Molly Reynolds joins us via Microsoft Teams. Molly, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Molly, we can't get enough of analyzing our recent midterm elections. I'd like to get your take now that we're into more than a week after the results have been coming in. Talk about the fact that the Republicans didn't really get the number of seats they had expected in the House of Representatives. How much more difficult for them will it be, do you think, with a very slim majority in the House of Representatives to reach consensus? And does that lessen their ability to frustrate or block President Biden's or the Democrats' agenda next year?
So I think it's helpful to first think a little bit about why are we in this situation where Republicans are looking at a much narrower majority than they were expecting to have in the House. And the reason that they were expecting a much larger majority, and I think the reason many folks who watch Congress were expecting a much larger majority, is because that's what history tells us to expect. So if we look at midterm elections, in the even numbered years between presidential elections, going back to World War II in the United States, in almost every midterm, the president's party loses seats. And obviously, in this case, the Democrats are going to lose the majority in the House, but they're not going to lose it by nearly as many seats as many folks were expecting. I think the expectation of big losses was driven largely by President Biden's low approval ratings, by the state of the economy. And then we had, kind of going with that, these countervailing forces involving both the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case, which dramatically limited abortion rights over the summer, and then also concerns that I'll put under the heading of attacks on democracy, typified by the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. So kind of the landscape in which we had the midterms happen. And I think that what will be challenging for Republicans in the House going forward is managing to do things that are really important for filling the basic responsibilities of governing in the United States. So We're talking about divided government either way. So we have the House controlled by Republicans, the Senate controlled by Democrats narrowly, and then a Democratic president in the White House. Frankly, even if Republicans had had huge gains in the House and had picked up a majority in the Senate, there was still, for the next 2 years, going to be a Democratic president who was positioned to veto, you know, many of the kinds of Republican policy priorities that even a unified Republican Congress would have wanted to see happen. So what we have now is this narrow Republican majority in the House that's likely to have some trouble getting through even what we would call kind of messaging bills, so bills that signal to voters where Republicans stand on issues. And then we'll also, I think, have trouble potentially delivering the votes on their own for things like funding the government and raising the debt limit.
You summarized some of the main factors that allowed the Democrats to do better in the midterms. Of course, the Roe v. Wade decision, the overturning of abortion rights. And now there are concerns about the integrity of our democracy. And some of the candidates that former President Trump endorsed were election denying. At any rate, the Republicans in the House of Representatives now are fighting over, you know, what their priorities are. And like you said, the slim majority will make it more difficult for them. At the same time, the Democrats control the Senate and the White House. So we have to decide what can be done. Does the fact that the Democrats control the Senate mitigate any efforts by Republicans to push back against Biden and the Democrats? And, you know, how much does that offset Republican control of the House of Representatives? Are we looking at a recipe for gridlock?
Yeah, so here I think it's helpful to think about three basic functions of the United States Congress. So one, in the context of the Senate specifically, is the responsibility to offer advice and consent on the president's nominees. So this is nominations to federal judgeships. It's also nominations to high-level positions in the executive branch. So cabinet secretaries, some other high-level agency officials kind of supervise all of the civil servants who work in executive agencies. The fact that Democrats now will definitely control the Senate, will definitely have a Senate majority, and depending on the outcome of a runoff election in Georgia, the first week of December, may ultimately have a 51-vote majority. So their majority in the Senate may not depend on the vice president being available to break ties. That means a lot for Congress's ability and the Senate's ability to execute on this particular responsibility of Congress, which is really important to the president. So the Senate will be able to confirm federal judges without needing to get votes from Republicans. It will be able to confirm executive branch appointments without needing to get votes from Republicans. If the Democrat Senator Warnock does win that runoff election in Georgia the first week in December, that will mean Democrats have 51 seats, which will make it even easier than it is now for the Democrats to confirm nominees in the Senate. What's been true for the past almost 2 years with the 50-50 tie in the Senate is that Democrats have been able to process nominees, but in certain situations, they've had to go through some extra procedural hoops because of the tie, and they would no longer need to kind of waste that time to jump through all the hoops that they do now in some situations in the Senate. So that's one place where a Senate majority for Democrats matters a great deal for Congress's relationship with the executive branch going forward. Second fundamental responsibility of Congress, legislation. So here, because we have a Republican majority in the House and a Democratic majority in the Senate and a Democratic president, I think we should expect to see a less productive Congress than we've seen over the past 2 years. The unified party control that we've seen over the past 2 years has really facilitated a number of big legislative achievements. Some of them have been on a partisan basis. So things like the American Rescue Plan, which is the big piece of legislation passed in March of 2021 to really support the U.S. as it continued to respond to the COVID pandemic, then the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed in August, which has a number of health provisions, a number of energy and climate provisions. Those were both done using particular procedures that allowed them to move on a party line basis. We also saw some relatively big bipartisan legislative efforts over the last 2 years, including most notably a large infrastructure bill that passed in August of 2021. And so we've seen a fair amount of legislation over the past few years, and I think we should just expect to see less of it over the next 2 years because of this divided party control in Congress, and because I think there are some differences in kind of the policy priorities and just the appetite for government involvement generally between the Democrats and the Republicans. Republicans tend to favor less government, fewer federal programs. And so I think that there's just going to be less of an appetite for government action in addition to the nature of the divided party control. And then the third big thing that Congress does in addition to nominations and legislation is conduct oversight. And here is actually, I think, the place where we'll see the biggest difference between the current Congress, particularly the current House of Representatives, and the new House of Representatives that gets seated in January of 2023. So in the House of Representatives, when party control switches from Democrats to Republicans, that means that Republicans will have control of all of Congress's committees. All of the chairs of all of those committees will be Republicans, and they will get to set the agenda for what those committees do with their time, what kinds of investigations they choose to conduct. And Republicans have made it very clear that they intend to conduct a whole range of investigations related to the Biden administration, and in some cases, perhaps to President Biden and his family personally. And because they will control the majority on these committees, they will be able to make that change. If you think of this as a bus, they'll be able to turn that bus very quickly. One question that I think is an open one for me, at least, when we think about the size of the majority, kind of how narrow the majority is likely to be, there may be more kind of political constraints within the Republican Party on how aggressive some of that investigation activity is. I think we'll still see it, but I don't know if we should expect to see House Republicans try to impeach Joe Biden with the very narrow majority they have, because they would really need basically almost all, if not all, of their members to vote in favor of that if they were going to try and do it. So I think that there may be some constraints imposed by the narrow majority for Republicans in the House on some of the kind of most aggressive oversight tools. But I do think we really should expect to see a number of investigations by House committees of the Biden administration.
Molly Reynolds, thank you so much for that terrific overview of the House of Representatives and how things will be different next year. So let's take a quick break. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Molly Reynolds. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Fatih Jahanbakhsh from Tehran, Iran. Thank you so much for writing in and following us on Facebook. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to Molly Reynolds as we discuss the 118th Congress. Molly, perhaps let's backtrack very quickly and look and see what the Biden administration can do, and unified government, that is the Democratic Senate and the Democratic House of Representatives, what they can do in the few days left in this 117th Congress. We call that lame duck session, right? Until the new Congress is sworn in early next January. You know, a lot of analysts are saying there's so many things they need to do. Maybe given the insurrection on January 6th and former President Trump's attempt to overturn the election, that Congress should reform the so-called Electoral Count Act, raise the debt ceiling. How do you see the kind of activity legislation taking place in the waning days of the 117th Congress?
So I think there are three things to keep an eye on in the last 6 weeks or so of the year. Congress will be in session for only some of those. They will, for example, be out of session for the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday. And like university students everywhere, Congress also does not like to work very close to the Christmas holiday. So that is often an effective deadline for trying to force some action by Congress. I think Congress's highest priority in these closing weeks is reaching a deal on government spending for the rest of the current fiscal year. So Congress has a deadline of December 16th by which it needs to pass at least a temporary spending bill. I think the hope is that by December 16th, they will have reached an overall agreement on the measures necessary to fund many federal programs, including military spending, education spending, spending on scientific research, that sort of thing. All of that they will be working on with the hopes of getting that done by December 16th. The second thing that I think we'll hear a lot of discussion about is whether the Congress has the time and the energy to address the debt limit in these closing weeks of the year. So in the United States, we have a statutory limit on the public debt, which basically means that if Congress does not periodically take action to raise that limit, the U.S. risks defaulting against its creditors and really ushering in pretty catastrophic economic consequences globally. The estimates on the deadline by which Congress needs to address the debt limit are not until the third quarter of 2023, so sometime the middle to end of next year. The challenge is that folks are worried that with a very narrow Republican majority in the House and the history of the House Republican Conference on the debt limit issue, that there is some concern that if Democrats don't address the debt limit now and they leave it until next year when they would have to negotiate with a Republican-controlled House, that those Republicans in the House would try to take, we would say, the debt limit hostage, try to leverage that really important issue to try and extract concessions from the Democrats. This is what happened in 2011. In the summer of 2011, the U.S. came as close as it's ever come to defaulting on its debt, and it was because of a show down engineered by some House Republicans who really wanted to see very large spending cuts in exchange for their votes to raise the debt limit. There's a lot of discussion over whether folks think we would see a replay of those circumstances next summer, whether Congress should try to raise the debt limit now to avoid that situation. So that's one other thing. And then there's kind of, I'll just say, everything else. There's a number of other pieces of legislation that I think folks are hoping will get done in the next several weeks. One is a big annual defense policy bill that Congress works on every year that might also be a useful vehicle for moving some other priorities as well. There's a question of whether Congress will take up legislation to reform what's known as the Electoral Count Act, which is our 19th century law that governs the actual process of counting the votes from the Electoral College. So that mechanism for selecting our president. The Electoral Count Act was one of the things involved in the insurrection on January 6, 2021. And so there's been a real effort to try and make some reforms to it that would really clarify and really close some of the loopholes that folks tried to exploit in that period between Election Day 2020 and the counting of the electoral votes on January 6, 2021. So those are just some of the things that I'll be paying attention to in the next couple of weeks, and we'll see how much of that Congress manages to get done.
Indeed. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has quite a number of matters to attend to in this lame duck session. And I think he also would like to codify same-sex marriage. We shall see among the priorities you just mentioned what can be done before the House of Representatives itself transfers to Republican hands. Let me ask you another question about the Senate, about which you are very, very familiar. It's our favorite parliamentary procedure, the good old filibuster. Molly, you authored a book about this arcane Senate procedural rule. Very briefly, explain the purpose of this parliamentary maneuver for the Senate. You know, what is it meant to achieve, and why there's so much controversy and so much debate about whether that should be abolished? You might want to give us a very brief history of how that has been modified.
Basically, in the U.S. Senate, there's nothing in the Senate's actual rule book that allows for a motion to end debate on a measure and move on to taking a final passage vote on it by just a simple majority vote. The history here is long and involves a little bit of a quirk and potentially accidental change to the Senate's rules in the early 19th century, of which they did not foresee the full consequences. But basically, it means that there's no way to end debate on most legislation and move to a final passage by simply having a simple majority vote. Since the early 20th century, since 1917, there has been a motion in the Senate that allows the Senate to cut off debate and move on to final passage with a supermajority of votes. Right now, that supermajority is set at 3/5 of the Senate's membership, so 60 votes. So when you hear folks say most legislation in the Senate needs 60 votes to pass, what they really mean is that most legislation in the Senate needs 60 votes to cut off debate and move on to a vote on final passage. And that's sort of how the filibuster shapes a lot of legislative policymaking in the Senate. And in terms of why does it matter, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. But basically, in the current era of American politics, where we generally see very narrow majorities for either party in the Senate, it means that to get most things done, it requires working with the other party. It requires some bipartisanship. And this really limits the ability in a lot of situations for a majority party to accomplish its partisan goals. There are some procedural exceptions to the filibuster. Probably the most famous is this process known as the budget reconciliation process. Exactly how that works is not as important as knowing that it provides in some situations for certain types of policy and allows for legislating without the threat of a filibuster. It's how Democrats accomplished some of their major legislative goals over the past 2 years, but it's really limited in what you can do with it. And it has become a tool that is seen as largely a partisan one. And so I think, you know, we would not expect in the next 2 years, for example, to see budget reconciliation return because of this divided party control across the chambers. In terms of the future of the filibuster, when we think about that, what we need to think about is kind of two dynamics. The first is, what is the issue on which a Senate majority will agree and care so deeply about that they are willing to make a fundamental change to the way the Senate's rules work and in the way the entire chamber operates to get that policy initiative across the finish line? We might think of this using an analogy of a river. We might think of the filibuster as it currently exists as sort of a dam that is stopping various legislative priorities from moving with its 60-vote threshold. There are all kinds of issues backed up behind that dam that might be important to a majority party, but only some of those issues are so important to the party and that they want to get done so badly that they're willing to break the dam to get them accomplished. And so in the future, a question would really be like, well, what is the issue on which a Senate Republican majority in a situation where they also control the House and they also control the White House would want to break that dam, would be willing to change the way the Senate works? Once that happens, there are all these other issues that are upriver, that are upstream, that are going to flow much more easily downstream once the dam is gone. But those are different than the thing that actually causes a Senate majority to break the dam in the first place. Over the past 2 years, we saw a lot of pressure on Democrats in the Senate to try and break that dam from other senators, from members of the House, from outside groups. But there was no issue on which the current very narrow Democratic majority agreed and was willing to make a change to the Senate rules to get it accomplished. That might arise for Republicans in the future, but I think we would have to look at exactly what the politics are and exactly what the makeup of a Republican party in the Senate would be in that hypothetical future to know what that issue might be.
And just remind us briefly, Molly, what were some of those issues for so many Democrats?
So the most prominent one over the last 2 years was a call to abolish the filibuster in order to pass comprehensive voting rights legislation through the U.S. Senate. So over the past decade or so, we have seen a real erosion of voting rights in some cases via decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, but it is now more difficult than it should be for many voters in the United States to access the ballot box. And there was a lot of pressure on Democrats to abolish the filibuster in order to accomplish voting rights legislation in the Senate. And that did not happen. There was also, particularly in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case, which overturned a previous decision known as Roe v. Wade that protected some access to abortion services nationwide, there was some pressure on Democrats to maybe eliminate the filibuster in order to pass a national abortion rights protection. But Democrats did not do either of those things. And so we still have the filibuster around, at least for the next 2 years, under divided party control.
Indeed, it's a fascinating topic. Molly, as we go forward for the House of Representatives, we're still waiting for the contours, but they will have a majority that is the Republicans. But we also see a lot of infighting. I'm wondering how you foresee their majority and the infighting among some of the Republicans who are really MAGA Republicans, very much Trump-oriented. And then the more, I don't know if there's such a thing as a mainstream Republican anymore, but nonetheless, how will that dynamic affect their ability to agree on oversight and the types of things that they intend to do, particularly regarding oversight of the Biden administration? What do you see as some of their issues, barring impeachment, which you just said earlier is probably not going to get done?
Yeah, so I think in the context of oversight, it will be really important who the specific chairs of the committees in the House are, because the chairs have quite a lot of power over setting a committee's oversight agenda. So we know or expect, for example, that Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, who is very antagonistic towards the Biden administration, is expected to become the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. So I would think that that would be a committee that would be doing a lot of aggressive oversight of the Biden administration, because it would be led by someone who's very clearly articulated that as a priority. The House also has kind of more general purpose oversight committee that can do oversight of various elements of the federal government. We've seen reports that Republicans are really sort of jockeying to get on that committee. I think that's also an indication that we should expect them to do some pretty aggressive oversight. And so I think that in the oversight context, it will really matter a great deal sort of what the priorities of the individual chairs of those committees are. I think more generally in the legislative context, again, because we have divided government, I think we should have pretty low expectations for legislating in the 118th Congress, except for these sort of basic core responsibilities of the Congress that it really needs to accomplish. So things like raising the debt limit and keeping the government open. And I think those are the places where the Republican Speaker of the House, who we think is likely to be Kevin McCarthy from California, where his ability to either get many of his Republican colleagues to vote for a deal that also gets the support of Democrats in the Senate and of a Democratic president, or a willingness to turn to Democrats in the House and say, you know what, I can't deliver these votes from my own side of the aisle. I'm coming to you because we really need to do this in order to avoid major economic consequences, especially in the case of the debt limit. And then the big question is, will McCarthy be willing to make those kinds of deals when he can't deliver the votes from members of his own party? And that challenge is made even bigger given the narrow majority.
That's going to be fascinating to watch. There's no question about that. To what extent he may have to turn to Democrats because he would not have enough Republican votes, which makes all the more important raising the debt ceiling in this lame duck session where Democrats are still in control. But as we close, Molly Reynolds, we have also the 2024, the presidential race. I assume that complicates things for the 118th Congress. You have former President Trump throwing his hat in the ring. How much will the Republican House in particular be constrained in terms of that? And the Biden administration, will they be mostly on the defense then during this 118th Congress?
When I think about ways that former President Trump re-entering the presidential race for 2024 might make a difference in Congress in the next 2 years, I think a lot about the times when Trump was in office, when Republican members of Congress, especially in the House, were often swayed to do things based on what President Trump said he did or did not want. And I think that if Trump decided to insert himself in some legislative debates in the 118th Congress, that could be consequential for where some of his most loyal supporters, particularly in the House, are concerned. And then I also think that even for Republican members of both the House and the Senate who are less overtly supportive of President Trump, there will be a lot of times when they are forced to talk about and take positions on things that Trump has said. And so that will certainly be part of the overall storyline, even if it's not so much a part of the actual legislative process.
President Biden said in a press conference after the elections where, you know, he was quite happy with the results, knowing that Democrats, they would be holding the Senate, and he thought the Democrats did much better. And he said in an answer to a question, you know, what would you change going forward? He said, we're going to just keep going. What he meant was that he's proud of what he's achieved and all of these bills, some of which you mentioned, and that he would just go forward knowing that he would be constrained passing more legislation. So that leads me to ask you, to what extent can the House of Representatives, with its very slim majority and with the Democratic Senate, try to reverse any of the legislative accomplishments of the Biden administration thus far?
So there are probably ways that they can make life difficult for implementation of some of Biden's priorities. I think the most likely candidate for this is President Biden made a big deal of working with Congress to increase funding for the Internal Revenue Service, so the agency that administers U.S. tax law and policy, a bunch of new spending to hire more IRS agents to make sure that people are actually paying their taxes like they're supposed to be. It's very unpopular among Republicans. I could easily imagine House Republicans insisting on reducing funding for the IRS or something like that. But I think on sort of the big, major, big picture things, because President Biden is still in the White House and because Democrats still do control the Senate, we should expect most of his legislative accomplishments to remain in place for at least the next 2 years.
Molly Reynolds is a senior fellow in governance studies at the prestigious Brookings Institution. Molly Reynolds, thank you so much for your terrific insights. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.